Welcome to the Science Podcast for April 13th, 2012. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. This week's Science contains a special section on computational biology. So for this show, we bring you two stories on computation, one on quantitative modeling applications in cell biology, and another on virtual animals, as well as a story about women in science and our usual roundup from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org. For millennia, scientists have described the physical processes around us using mathematics. Yet, the highly complex life sciences largely remained qualitative. The last few decades of biological research have seen a shift towards more quantitative analysis, exemplified by recent developments in the field of cell polarity. The lead author of a review this week, Alex McGillner, spoke with me about quantitative biological models and how they are advancing our understanding of the cell.
What we emphasize is that a model is not an endpoint of the study. And moreover, we are not progressing from simpler to more and more complex and comprehensive models, but rather we are saying that modeling is a tool in a way similar to microscopy, biochemistry, genetics. And as this tool, model can be simple or it can be very complex, it can be conceptual, it can be mechanistic. The main thing is not how comprehensive and how complex it is, but rather how helpful it is in the process of biological discovery.
So many other fields of science already use quite a lot of computational methods, quite a lot of quantitative models. Why has biology sort of lagged behind in using these methods?
So it is useful to compare biology with physics and engineering. And in physics, which was quantitative and mathematical for hundreds of years, what we deal with is complex interactions of many elements, but those elements are pretty much the same. For example, in ideal gas, we have just two types of molecules. In crystals, we have just a few types of molecules. And so the laws that govern behavior of a huge number of few types of elements are not that complicated. So they can be captured by mathematics. In a way, biology is very different in character. It deals with also a great number of interacting agents or elements, but those elements are very diverse. There are thousands of different molecules interacting in the cell. And in this sense, biology is similar to engineering. For example, the inventory of parts that are used to build a plane consists of a few tens of thousands of entries, and it's accidentally the same order of magnitude of number of proteins that are in our body.
Oh, cool.
And so it's very difficult to find out what are the mathematical rules, mathematical patterns behind this complexity. But then, of course, the thing is, engineering is also mathematical for many years, simply because it deals with much, much simpler machines and structures.
You also go on in your paper to say that in the last 20 years, the field of biology has met a little bit more or has gained a little bit of momentum in terms of these computational models. So what precipitated that surge?
I would say there are three major factors. One is much more detailed knowledge of cell and molecular biological processes. The success of microscopy, genetics, biochemistry told us what's the molecular inventory in the cell and what are the essential interactions. So now we can use mathematics to examine very specific problems. The second factor is successes of omics, genomics, proteomics, and so on, which illustrated to everybody how power of computational approaches can help. And the third factor is that about 50 years ago, there were two remarkable papers, one by Alan Turing and another by Hodgkin and Huxley, which really revolutionized mathematical approaches to biology. So Turing's approach was very abstract, and for many years it remained mathematical abstraction, beautiful one, but still abstraction. But suddenly in the last 20 years it became clear that many phenomena in cell biology can be described by it. On the other hand, the model by Hodgkin and Huxley was very specific, very much based on experimental data, and it really showed that combination of mathematics and experimental approach can decipher a very complicated process.
So since all of these advances, there's been a particular success story that you outline in your paper in the field of cell polarity, in particular in the cell polarity in yeast. So can you outline just how these quantitative computational models have elucidated this this very complex process?
Yeah, so we chose yeast polarity because there's this dramatic surge of papers in the last decade that combined experimental results and mathematical modeling in a very innovative and judicious way to decipher the puzzle of cell polarization. The problem is yeast cell prior to cell division or prior to mating polarizes, which means certain protein CDC42 aggregates to a patch on the yeast surface. In the absence of any special cues on the surface. And in a way, this process is a paradigm for a lot of phenomena in cell biology. It's one of the most basic processes explaining how the cell understands space, orientation, how it becomes structured.
So what kinds of models were helpful in, you know, understanding cell polarity? Was it just focusing on one specific part of this process, or was it a whole variety?
Yeah, the answer is all kinds of models were useful, and that's, I think, the main lesson of our story. For example, this stochastic model of polarization that Altshuler and collaborators came up with is very, very small and very simple model, and it's a really conceptual model, which means you don't need specific parameters. It just examines very specific yet non-trivial concept. On the other hand, the model that Garyachev and Danny Liu came up with, it's big, it consists of a large number of equations, it's very detailed, it's based on many parameters, and it was equally useful because it advanced our biological knowledge. So one of the remarkable part of this story is that where all these parameters come from is a very painful question, because in cell biology it's much harder to measure parameters than in engineering and in physics. But Danny Liu and his group, and actually Rong Li and her group, went to a great deal of pain and expense and time to actually measure parameters in their models. So some models, as I said, were very detailed, very mechanistic, but still, the lesson is that some super simple conceptual models, like the one Altshuler came up with, and actually Van Oudenaarde had another very simple model, were also very useful. So any kind of model, if it is used together with experiment and if the question asked is right, any kind of model becomes useful.
So it seems like on the one hand, these models have proven to be extremely versatile and all will help understand some part of the process. And yet our current knowledge of yeast polarity kind of relied on all of these models and all of these years and all of these research teams. I mean, if it's this complicated, will there be a place for this kind of modeling in the future of biology, do you think? Is it worth all this effort?
I think so. I would phrase it like that. Nobody would ask, well, why do we do microscopy all the time? Haven't we done it enough? I think it's pretty much the same with modeling. Every time new problem comes up and we have to solve it, as far as there's quantitative data involved and quantitative questions are asked, there has to be some appropriate model that helps us to understand, because many processes are so complicated that intuition simply fails. So I think in the future, it'll be pretty much more of the same. Similar kind of modeling that was done before will be used in the future in many studies. However, future discoveries, of course, can show some new avenues of modeling. For example, network analysis was pretty much unheard of up to something like 15 years ago. And it could be that another mathematical or computer tool discovered will show us how to consider models of much more complicated and diverse processes.
Great. Well, Alex McGillner, thank you so much.
Sure. My pleasure.
Alex McGillner and colleagues write about quantitative modeling as a tool as part of this week's special section on computational biology at sciencemag.org/site/special/compbio.
Want more science in your life? Check us out on Facebook and Twitter at Science Magazine, where you can read highlights, join discussions, or take your best shot at our weekly quiz.
Is female underrepresentation in scientific faculty a result of jumping ship or getting pushed off? In an April 6 Science Career Story, Beryl Leaf Benderly examines how cultural changes have altered women's status in clinical medicine, but not in academic settings. Benderly spoke with Denisha Adams of Science Careers about the story.
In your article, you discuss research by Stephen Cece and Wendy Williams. Can you tell me about their findings?
Yes. Well, Stephen Cece and Wendy Williams are co-directors of the Cornell University Institute for Women in Science, and they have been researching the progression of women in science and also what barriers or issues may be affecting the numbers of women who are pursuing careers in academic science. They published an article in the current issue of American Scientist in which they summarize a lot of their own and other people's research. And they state that the most significant issue in the women's underrepresentation is not discrimination, as was previously thought, but at the present time, actually is not only the desire to have children, but the fact of having children.
Is this a very controversial idea?
Of course, there are many people who are, as Stephen Cece said in the interview I had with them, wedded to the idea that discrimination is the main issue. He says that people who, of course, have held a view for a long time aren't happy about giving it up. And of course, discrimination was very important in the past. A lot of effort went into overcoming the discrimination. And so they both say that, in fact, it is a very controversial view among many people. But they believe that the research definitely supports this view. A very interesting fact is that women who do not plan to have children, their career progression and career decision-making is apparently extremely close to men's. And in fact, they often progress more rapidly than men because departments are eager to hire women and promote women.
Cece calls for a type of culture change.
Yes.
What does he mean by this?
His research, and also research by other researchers, indicates that the biggest block to women is the conflict in the late 20s to 30s, which is the prime childbearing period for women. If women want to take off, say, a year or two or slow down or maybe take an adjunct or some kind of position that would be less stressful and then go back for tenure, what he and Williams have found is that that simply doesn't happen because the hiatus is considered an indication of lack of seriousness. Seems to me, and also they said to them, that if a person has children and then comes back and tries to get back on the tenure track, that actually is an indication of very great seriousness. But the traditional culture of academe, which of course was based around male needs and preferences, didn't take account for any hiatus. And so what they say would really help with the advancement of women in academic science would be a recognition that the fact that a person who's a good researcher has an excellent record up until the hiatus and tries to do something that will keep their hand in science during the hiatus, this person is a serious scientist and can be a good researcher again and should be considered for the tenure track position.
You have made the point that this is clearly an issue in the academic setting, but in your article, you suggest that medicine has made some changes that have worked for women. Can you talk about that?
In my article, I give the example of pediatrics, which is one of the specialties that is now predominantly female, and a very high percentage of the young physicians entering the pediatric residency are women. And I spoke with a pediatrician who's a man in his 70s who has been in pediatric private practice for 40 years, and he says that it's changed very drastically over the period of his career, because it used to be, when all pediatricians were male, they worked very long hours. They'd have to go out at night to see patients in their office or the hospital, take the calls and everything, visit the hospital every day. And the young women pediatricians coming out of residency simply refused to accept that. So that practices who wanted to attract top people had to adapt. And how they adapted was by making the work hours much more predictable. They no longer meet the patients at night. There were now after-hours clinics that are specifically for the purpose of people who need care at night or else to the emergency room. They no longer care for their own hospitalized patients, but there are now hospital-based pediatricians who care for the patients who have to be admitted to the hospital. The interesting thing is that women, according to CeCe, have children at higher rates than in a number of other professions, including academics, and they have more children because they have a lot more control over their careers and their schedules. And research also shows that taking a hiatus or going part-time for a while doesn't really hurt the career of a physician in private practice. Now, in academic medicine, that's a different story because old academic rules appear to be more prevalent. The kind of organization or the time constraints of medical practice have really changed markedly to meet the demands of female physicians in fields where women are very numerous.
So, this is still an issue in academic medicine and academic science. Are these problems keeping women from applying for tenure-track positions?
Now, a very interesting thing is that half of biomedical PhDs now are going to women. A third of PhDs in math are going to women. However, women who are qualified, they have their PhDs, they've done postdocs, but they apply for tenure-track jobs at research universities at a lower rate, substantially lower rate than comparable men, because many of them perceive that pursuing an academic career is going to be in conflict with other important life goals, namely having a family. Therefore, if universities want these women to apply for these positions, the positions have to be more attractive. That is to say, the women have to believe that they're going to succeed at the career and it's not going to prevent them from achieving a really important life goal for many people. Men do not have to make this decision, Williams and CeCe kept saying over and over, because men with children actually advance in their careers more rapidly than men without children. Maybe they're more motivated to make sure they have a secure job, but the opposite is true for women. Women with children, on average, advance in their careers less rapidly than women without children.
Well, how can academic science start to reflect some of these practices that have been so successful in medicine?
All it would require is saying, oh, this person took off 2 years or whatever to have children, but look at all the wonderful work she's done. She has all these publications. She's worked with all these important scientists. She's obviously a really good scientist. She can get back up to speed as soon as she wants to. Therefore, we'll just ignore that. It would also, in fact, free men, because there are a number of men who wouldn't mind easing up when they have small children. Until that happens, CeCe and Williams imply that women are not going to choose to apply for those positions.
Well, thank you, Burley Fenderly, for stopping through today to speak with us.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Burley Fenderly is a contributor to Science Careers magazine. You can read her article, What the Doctors Ordered, at sciencecareers.sciencemag.org.
Animal modeling may bring back memories of elementary school art class, but for some scientists, models of animals are computationally advanced and extremely informative. Science news writer Elizabeth Panisi has the story on just what virtual animals can tell us.
So this is a story about biologists who couldn't answer a question by just doing lab or field studies, so they turned to computer modeling for help. They wanted to know how animals fare in changing temperatures. So they combine weather and climate information with morphological and physiological and even behavioral data to predict how an organism does under different conditions. The work is helping to clarify the effects of global warming.
So we already know, at least, you know, animals that live in tropical conditions don't fare very well in cold conditions and vice versa. What can these models tell us about the animals' interaction with their environment that we don't already know?
What it gives us is details about how animals actually interact with their environment on a specific level. So we know in general that global warming can be bad, but we don't really know how it can be bad. And this actually lets us know specifically how it will affect the distribution of animals, what they have to do differently to cope with increased temperatures and things like that.
And so what sorts of variables are these scientists taking into account in their climate models?
Well, they look at temperature, they look at wind conditions, and they look at a place and how the temperature of a place changes as the sun grows across the sky.
So, in other words, just sort of knowing the air temperature is not necessarily enough, but, you know, knowing the ground temperature or the position of the sun and shade and things like that also matter.
Yes, it does matter.
So what kinds of animals have been modeled in this way?
Well, in my story, we talk about lizards and turtles and mussels, but the approach has been applied to many species, frogs, birds, insects, even extinct animals.
And how crude or how advanced are these models? Do they actually look like the animals, or are they just sort of, you know, a piece of silly putty with legs?
Well, in the early days, they were very crude in the sense that, say, a lizard would be represented by a cylinder. But now they actually have the ability to create more realistic three-dimensional virtual animals.
So let's take the case study of sea turtles. Walk me through the models that have been made and what they've been able to tell us.
So this is a fairly new modeling project being done by Warren Porter at the University of Wisconsin. And they want to know how the distribution of leatherback turtles, which are 2.5 meters long, might change as the oceans warm. So they start out, what they need to do is figure out how much heat a turtle generates as it swims, and therefore how cool the water has to be to keep it cool enough to keep going. What they do is they build a model, a virtual model of a turtle. What they did is they took measurements from hatchlings and fed that into a 3D modeling program and created a 3D model of the turtle. After they did that, they took this 3D model and they plugged it into a fluid dynamic simulation program so they could make the turtle swim.
Wow.
And see how much drag and energy was used. And from that energy, they calculated, okay, this is what temperature the turtle needs to swim in. And what they will do then is they will look at data about sea surface temperatures and overlay that over their data about what temperature the sea turtle needs and figure out where the turtle will be.
So it involves some pretty advanced fluid dynamics and such.
Right.
So I imagine there are a lot of assumptions that need to go into these models. Are they then fact-checked against any real-life data to see how accurate they are?
So models are simplified versions of reality, and so the critics say that the models aren't very good. But the researchers who are involved in the studies do a lot of testing of the models and doing field studies to help try and figure out how good the models and make the models better. So, for example, one researcher is looking at mussels and how mussels will do in different temperatures. And he has built these plastic mussels that have temperature sensors inside them and put them in mussel beds and actually record what the temperatures are that the mussels experience. And he looks at those and see how well they coincide with the temperatures he's predicted from his models.
Okay, so what can scientists now go and do with all of this information that they're collecting?
Well, what it does, it gives them insights into how the animals live. And that's something that they want to know and want to understand. But it also can be useful for conservation. Mm-hmm. One study of lizards has shown that the lizards do best and it can be active more time during each day in the desert if they have lots of shade in small patches. And this is something when they evaluate what kind of habitat a threatened lizard would do best in, they can figure out that these complex environments are better.
Great. Well, Elizabeth Panisi, thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much.
Elizabeth Panisi's News Focus article entitled Virtual Hotspots accompanies this week's special section on computational biology and can be found at sciencemag.org/site/special/compbio.
Finally today, David Grimm, online news editor of Science, is here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. Okay, so first up, David, we have a story about why the Bering Strait land bridge did more in our past than just let people go from continent to continent.
Right. Well, Sarah, for those out there who don't know this, the Bering Strait land bridge was this strip of land that connected what is modern-day Siberia to Alaska. And not only did animals seem to have crossed it tens of thousands of years ago, but human beings may have too. In fact, some of the earliest settlers in North America may have arrived via the land bridge. Well, this new study says the land bridge also may have had another very important impact. It may have caused very violent and random temperature swings about 80,000 years ago.
So how can the land bridge's existence have caused these changes in temperature?
Well, that's the sort of the question that the researchers are trying to figure out. What they do know is that starting about 80,000 years ago, every decade or so, the temperature rose or fell by 10 degrees Celsius, which is a lot. And this happened for 70,000 years. So you had this really long period of time where the temperature was just going up and down all the time. I mean, imagine on Earth, the temperature going up and down 10 degrees every decade. It's really crazy. Researchers didn't originally think the land bridge had anything to do with it. They thought, well, maybe there was some sort of variation in the sun's activity, or there was some other sort of unstable climatic process going on. Researchers ran some climate simulations. And what they did was, they ran some simulations in which the Bering Strait is what they call open, which means it's sort of like it is today. There's no land bridge there. The North Pacific and the Arctic Ocean basically flow right into each other. And in the other simulation, the Bering Strait was closed, meaning there was this broad land bridge that was separating these two oceans. And then what they did was they virtually added a large amount of fresh water to the North Atlantic. And the reason they did this is because at the time, tens of thousands of years ago, fresh water was actually entering these oceans because ice sheets were melting during this time, especially during warm spells.
So they added this fresh water to the ocean, and what difference did whether the land bridge was there or not make?
What they saw was that in both simulations, both when the Bering Strait was open and closed, the surface waters became really, really fresh. In fact, they became so fresh with this fresh water, then the upper layer never really got denser than the underlying salty water and therefore never sank. And when this happens, it actually shuts down ocean circulation and plunges areas around the North Atlantic, including Greenland, into a cold spell. And that happened in both simulations. But there was one critical difference between the two simulations. When the Bering Strait was closed, it took about 1,400 years for ocean circulation to recover, versus when it was open, the circulation recovered just in about 400 years or less. And that's a sign that ocean circulation is stable when the strait is open. Because of a stable ocean circulation, you don't have these sort of dramatic rises and fall in temperature as you would have when the land bridge is there and ocean circulation is far less stable.
Well, so are we going to see any effect like this with global climate change?
Well, because of global climate change, actually, the sea level is going to continue to rise, which means that this Bering land bridge is going to be even under more water than it was before, which means the Bering Strait is going to be even more open, if that's possible, than it was before. So you shouldn't be looking forward to any violent swings in temperature anytime soon.
At least not caused by this.
And not caused by this, exactly.
So next up, we have a story that suggests where humans might have gotten their giant brains.
Right. Sarah, our brains, at least the average adult brain, weighs about 1.3 kilograms. It's got 100 billion neurons, and it sucks up 20% of the oxygen we breathe. This is a very needy organ, and it's not one that we actually need, or at least one that an animal our size needs. Our brains, compared to the size of our body, are bigger than that of any other animal on the planet. And the question is, for a long time, why do we have such big brains? One of the going hypotheses is it's because we need it to be social. You can think to your relationships with your friends, or you can think about Facebook, or you can think about whatever you want, but we have very complicated relationships with each other. We've got to keep track of who's our friend, who's our enemy, where we're ranking on the social ladder. All these things take a lot of computational power, and the idea has been that's the reason we have big brains. And researchers have actually seen correlations like that, not only in us, but in primates that are closely related to us. Other creatures with big brains, like dolphins, seem to live in very social societies. So this seems to support the hypothesis that for some reason we need big brains to be social.
So what's the new evidence that the story is about?
All this stuff that I just talked about is just a correlation. It doesn't actually show how our brains could have grown just by being social. So this study involves another computer simulation, but they're not simulating ocean currents here. They're actually simulating the growth of virtual brains. They started with 50 simple brains, and these are very simple brains. They actually just had 3 to 6 neurons each. Mm-hmm. And then they made these little brains play 2 classic games with each other. The object of both of these games are to sort of cooperate with your partner. And if you cooperate in the long run, you're more likely to do better at these games than if you don't cooperate.
And so what happened with the brains that did a better job cooperating?
So the brains that did a better job cooperating, these brains got to reproduce over and over, I think, 50,000 generations. And they also were subject to some random mutations that made them potentially bigger or smaller or more complex or less complex. And what the researchers found was that after 50,000 generations, the brains that were the best at cooperating were also the largest, kind of like what we see in ourselves and some of these other complicated animals. So this gives a potential sort of path, an evolutionary path, to how this all happened, that the idea is that as we evolved and became sort of a more cooperative society, our brains were also growing along with us.
Really interesting. Last up, we have a story about how shaking your head at a party might mean that you are listening or you're not listening.
This story is about something called the cocktail party problem. And if you've ever been in a noisy room or a loud bar and somebody's trying to talk to you, you know, for maybe the first couple seconds, it's kind of difficult because you've got people talking in the background, maybe glasses are clinking in the background, maybe music's playing, whatever. And you've got to separate out what your friend is saying to you from all the other noise in the room. And that's the researchers called that the cocktail party problem. This study is trying to figure out how our brain sort of resets itself, for lack of a better word, during this problem. Because after a couple seconds, we do hone in on that conversation. But there are things we can do, apparently, that sort of disrupt things again. And all of a sudden, we've got all these noises coming at us at once. We have a hard time filtering. And then we've got to sort of hone in on a conversation again.
So they used robots for this experiment,
yes,
which I was really surprised by.
Yes. You can actually see a video of what this robot looks like. It's actually kind of creepy. It's a humanoid robot. And the reason they use the robots is because they wanted to figure out, you know, when people were listening to a very complicated sound. And here's a sound that sounds something like the sound they used in the study. And you can see that there's actually a couple things going on in that sound. It's not just sort of one continuous noise. It's sort of a couple different things. And that's, you know, a very simplified version of the cocktail party problem where there's multiple signals coming in and you've got to separate one from the other. But it turns out when researchers want to see, you know, how we reset these noises in our brain, the head movements we make that we might sort of, as you said at the outset, sort of cock our head or make some funny head movements, it's really hard to track that stuff. The robot was sort of wired in such a way that it was moving its head in time with the way the person did. When they looked at the robot, they saw that a rapid head motion, maybe a rapid cock of the head or a turn of the head, actually disrupts this honing ability that we have, this ability to sort of separate out one sound from all of the other sounds or one sound from all of the background noise.
So shaking your head does clear out your ears.
Well, it kind of has the opposite effect because you're talking to somebody and you know, you're in a loud room and say I'm talking to you. I can hear what you're saying because I filtered your sound out from all the other sounds. But then I shake my head and actually all those sounds come rushing back to me again. So I've sort of reset it, which is actually kind of bad. It sort of says, you know, if you are paying attention to somebody in a crowded room, you shouldn't do a lot of rapid head motions because for at least a couple of seconds, you're going to lose that ability to really hone in on what that person is saying.
So one question that gets addressed at the end of the story is that a bug or a feature?
Right. It seems like a bug because it seems like, you know, we just talked about how complicated our brains are. You know, we should be able to move around a lot and not sort of lose the train of conversation or at least lose the honing ability that we've developed. But it's some sort of, you know, call it a bug, call it something else. But it seems that, you know, we're able to disrupt this very complicated ability by something as simple as shaking our head.
All right. So what else is on the site this week, David?
Well, Sarah, for Science Now, we've got a story about a group of college students solving a pothole problem with something called non-Newtonian fluids. We've also got a story about reading in baboons. And for Science Insider, our science policy blog, we've got a story about a dubious record that a researcher has just achieved. The most retractions for any single researcher in history, it appears. We've also got a story about a new bill in Tennessee that would allow teachers to challenge the teaching of evolution. Finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science. This week's Science Live is about the science of decision making. Why do we make the decisions we do, and what impact does it have on everything from buying cereal to voting in elections? And next week's Science Live is about human-triggered earthquakes. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
I will. Thanks, David.
Thanks, sir.
David Grimm is the online news editor for Science. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the April 13th, 2012 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.